Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at truth in sentencing laws in Wisconsin today. The September issue of Wisconsin Lawyer contains an opinion piece that the two guests today wrote in regards to giving judges sentencing options rather than a fixed determinant sentence. Talking about it today with Ken Strait. Ken's been on the program many times, UW-Madison Law School Clinical Associate Professor. Ken, great to have you with us. Thank you for
being
here.
Good to be here, Larry.
Also with me by phone today, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm, who was the co-author with Ken of the article. And John, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Oh, glad to be here, Larry. And hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Good, John.
Let's talk, John. Let me turn to you first. Why is this? You feel that there should be there are better options than determinant sentencing. Why is that important?
Both Ken and I have extensive experience, really from different perspectives of the public safety system. Obviously, Ken has extensive experience in the correctional system, and I've really worked in both the determinate and indeterminate framework of prosecution now for going on 15, 16 years. And what we've determined is that there's great aspects of both approaches, and there's useful structures that can actually keep people safe and make sure that we're accountable with the resources that are devoted to public safety. And much of what's driving our desire to reform the system is that we are faced with incredibly tough choices of how we use our scarce public safety resources, and we feel strongly that by allowing judges more options and allowing more information to be presented in the context of any given prosecution and sentencing, that we would be able to more effectively serve the interests of the community in a much more cost-effective and accountable way.
Yeah. Maybe I'll ask both of you this, and Ken, first start with you. How do you win release? How does someone win release for their parole?
Well, let's to just inform the audience. Up until January 1st, 2000, let's say, if a person committed a crime, that crime was a parolable crime. And what that basically meant is that when a judge gave a single number sentence, let's say a 12-year sentence, because the math works out pretty well on that, the person could be released as early as one quarter of that time, so at the third anniversary. And there was a concept of good time or mandatory release, which was at two-thirds. So somewhere in between that 3 years and 8 years is the time that the parole board would be taking a look at that person and saying, how have you been spending your time? Do we think you're continue to be a public safety risk and all that? So that was the old indeterminate time. Then truth in sentencing changed that totally. And the first truth in sentencing, the judge would say, I'm sentencing you to a total of 12 years. 9 years of that is going to be confinement, and 3 years of that is going to be extended supervision. Well, you just flipped your calendar 9 years, and you could write the date, and that was exactly the time that you were going to get out, and you couldn't do anything to earn your early release. Shortly thereafter, they then had what they called truth in sentencing two, because they realized there might be some advantages to allowing guys who had exceptional behavior to get out anywhere from 15% to 25% early. But the mechanism for that was extremely burdensome. And frankly, if I were a judge, I would never issue a sentence adjustment, because the paperwork that I had was maybe only a few pieces of paper compared to a parole commissioner who could look at the guy's entire file and had a much better understanding of what's missing in this record. So, you know, I just want to say, if I'm cautious as a judge, I'm going to always be wondering what else might be in this record that I should know about. Now we finally got to TIS 3, which was the last budget bill, and there are nearly a dozen different ways that they are trying to allow different people to get out. Not the most serious, not Class A, not Class B kind of felonies.
That's not what we're talking about.
But so anyway, that the normal way back in the old parole day was you would begin meeting with the parole commissioner. You would when you initially went into prison, they would do what they called an assessment and evaluation. They would say, Ken, you know, you're going to need some treatment for your addictions, or Larry, you're going to need some treatment for dealing with your anger or making bad decisions. And they would pretty much what I call front end the programming on that, so that if that person then completed that programming, when they met with the parole commissioners could say, you've completed the programming. and you don't need, we don't need to keep you here for more programming. And then they would also look at institutional behavior. The main thing that then got complicated in the 1990s, and I think John would agree with this, is that you had situations where the judge is trying to make it clear to the parole commission that says, no matter how well this person behaves, no matter how many programs he completes, I don't want him released a day early. But there was no way to communicate that clearly to the courts. And that's what then led to Truth in Sentencing, where they sort of totally took away the parole concept because there were a few people, and I would, John could maybe argue with me, but I'd say probably under 10%, where the judge really wanted to communicate that says, not a day early beforehand. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now.
That's right. And what and the thinking has really changed over time of how we describe the risk and the need to as it regards to the people that we're processing through the criminal justice system. And the reality is the Truth in Sentencing is a very effective tool for a certain category of offender. For those individuals that we've decided that we really just need to incapacitate them, we have to remove them from the community. And this is a category that I most often direct towards the violent offenders. These are individuals who've committed armed robberies, who've shot people, who are sexually violent. The Truth in Sentencing framework is ideal for that, and it really puts the emphasis on in a very straightforward, transparent way, incapacitating that person for a period of time and removing them from the community. Unfortunately, we know that the vast majority of the individuals that we deal with do not fall within that category. That's the 10% club right there. The remainder of our investment of resources and time and energy goes into dealing with individuals that would oftentimes benefit from a significant change in their behavior and a structured change. They have to be held accountable. They have to make reparations for the harm they've caused in the community, but they can often benefit from early intervention and resources that reintegrate them into the community. And that's where the Truth in Sentencing framework has not worked as effectively. And as a result, we've seen an enormous increase in revocations on Truth in Sentencing sentences that has resulted in an almost uncontrolled burgeoning of the correctional cost. We're spending close to $1.3 billion a year on our correctional system. And if you went back to the 1980s and 1990s, there was about a third of that cost, and we're projecting that it's going to become $2.5 billion soon if we don't make some significant changes. And what that, in practical terms, as a prosecutor, that is directly reflected in fewer resources that are given to me and to my office to do the public safety work that I think is so critical. And what we're really arguing is that if we put more ability in the hands of judges to fashion sentences that are really appropriate for both the victim and the offender, that we could do that in a much more effective and cost-effective way and keep the community safe and achieve the primary goal of the justice system, which is not to have any more victims. We, you know, the better job we do, the first chance we get with an individual to change that behavior and to stop that activity, that means fewer victims, that means fewer costs to the system, and that means that we can focus our resources on those really dangerous offenders that we know are going to cause a disproportionate amount of the harm.
Yeah. So just to make it clear, neither John nor I think that we should do away with TIS. So if you sort of think about it, the parolable system was, the pendulum was all the way at one end, and then we slammed it to the other end with TIS. And what we're really saying now is the pendulum should be swinging a little bit in the middle. And we're even arguing that there could be cases, and I think John and I would agree on this. So John says, okay, you know, for the most part, armed robbery or a robbery or whatever, that's the one that's most likely to get a TIS case. But we don't want in the legislation to have the legislation specifically picking and choosing which offenses, because there could be a strange situation where the guy who did an armed robbery, but because of other circumstances, the judge says, I think I'm okay with you earning your way out. You know, it's going to be a tough way to get out because I'm going to expect you to do a whole lot to get out. But if you can get that done, I think you could get out. Or similarly, you might want to have a sentence that, or a crime that a lot of us might say,
not a big deal.
It is not a big deal. But, you know, it's maybe a woman who has been chronically forging checks. And the prosecution in Milwaukee County has to bring her file in a cart, you know. And the judge just wants to say, no. Yeah. You know, this one, I want it really clear. You know, we're going to give you four consecutive terms. Mark your date, you know, that kind of stuff. So we believe that as opposed to the legislature picking and choosing which ones, the judges have an incredible, on the one hand, they have incredible discretion, but they have an incredible amount of information to figure out what's the appropriate sentence in this case.
Yeah, well, it seems to make sense that the judge who's right there and knows the person in a way and knows what they've done would have the better idea of what that to do than, say, our legislators.
What we acknowledge is that the participants themselves, the prosecutors, have close contact with their victims. They know what the victim's needs are. They work closely with law enforcement. They're being told what the risk that person poses to the community. And the defense bar, as a rule, has close access to the defendant that the prosecutors and law enforcement are not going to have. And they can find out using services like pretrial services and risk assessment tools and determining what the causes, the underlying causes of the person's involvement with the system. And by sharing that information right at the pivotal moment when you're going to exercise state power and either remove the person from the community or set a series of structures on that person so that they are held accountable and that are supervising the community, the more information that's available right at that pivotal moment and where the most discretion can be exercised and the most intelligent decision made is, in my view, the best system. And judges, as a rule, do a very good job of that when they're given enough information, when they can really balance the needs of the community and the risk posed by that particular individual. And what we've set up is a system that oftentimes does not give those judges the information to make that longer-term projection. And that's what we're really pushing towards is a system that's much, much more effective at giving them the critical information they need to make smart decisions.
One more thing. I think John would also agree on this. A lot of times the difficulty of doing a truth in sentencing sentence, say for a 19-year-old, is that, frankly, the guy isn't bringing much to the table at the time of sentencing. He maybe really has messed up. You know, he hasn't taken advantage of school. He's sort of a slacker or something like that. He hangs out with a rough crowd. He's maybe not addicted to alcohol, but he's sure using a lot of it. And he's not addicted to the drugs, but he's sure using a lot of it and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, to be fair, the judge doesn't really have a whole lot on the mitigating side.
Right.
This guy is clearly a work in progress. And we know enough about young men to say, for a whole bunch of them, they're not going to start turning the corner until they're a few years older on this thing. And some turn the corner and some don't turn the corner. That one, if I were a judge, is really tough if I'm doing a truth in sentencing sentence to say, so what number should I pick here?
Yeah.
You know, because I clearly want to know a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now, is this guy one of the good guys or is this guy just going to throw it away?
Yeah. And we'll continue our discussion with our two guests today, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm, UW-Madison Law School Clinical Associate Professor Ken Strait, as we talk with them about truth in sentencing here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with our discussion about truth in sentencing with the District Attorney for Milwaukee County, John Chisholm, and UW Law School Clinical Associate Professor Ken Strait. And callers online, you can join in again at 1-800-642-1234. You guys have talked about intervention programs and so forth and treatment programs. What do we have good treatment programs out there? What kinds of programs do offenders take before they can be returned to the community?
The original concept of prison, for the most part, was reform. And the idea was that this person needed additional tools to change their behavior. So that would range from education programs. A lot of people come into the Wisconsin's prison systems with a lot of deficiencies as far as educational skills. And then trying to treat head-on the different other programs. So a thing that's called cognitive intervention is basically saying, you know, you're a little bit different, Ken. When you see a situation, you see an opportunity for crime. Let's try to figure out why you could instead think differently. Or when you're frustrated, you lash out and you hit people. Let's try to figure out another plan for how to avoid getting into that situation. Addiction programs are tough. The people who have, so there's six levels of addiction thing that they go on in Wisconsin and prisons. And frankly, the first level is total outpatient kind of stuff. You do that when you're back in the community. When you're up to the sixth level, it's usually because you've bombed out in a whole bunch of other prior interventions, and you now need a year in a 24/7 residential setting where your total focus is on addiction. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they try to line them up with the programs. The difficulty that they have with truth in sentencing is most of the concepts are that the best time to have a program is when you can then immediately make a transition to the community where you sort of get an aftercare phase. So if I come in on a truth in sentencing sentence with 6 years confinement and they want me to do like a level 4 addiction program, they're not going to give it to me in the first years. They're going to make sure that that finishes just shortly before I'm out. But now with the TIS-3, all the different adjustment things, they can't really figure out what that out day is. So it becomes very complicated. Whereas in the past, on a parolable sentence, you'd say, okay, this person becomes parole eligible for this kind of thing. They generally do about 30%, 40% of their time. We'll get them set up so that they'll have their programs completed by that time, and we'll expect that the parole commission. So that's sort of the problem as far as not only having the programs, but figuring out when you're going to time them. Education is different. Education is always going to be upfront.
Our feeling is that if we were to adopt this framework, it would actually lend some clarity and structure to the Department of Corrections as a whole, where those individuals that were identified as the more significant threats, even when they return to the community, would receive a different type of supervision. It would be a high-intensity type of supervision, multiple meetings, contacts with their supervising agents, whereas those who were identified as lower on the risk scale would be directed more towards the services. And to your question, those services are available. They're not anywhere near as available and well-resourced as would be beneficial, but we certainly integrate many of them, and quite frankly, a lot of the services are provided for very low cost because the medical community as a whole has a strong interest in providing many of these treatment services.
Yeah. And it would be a lot cheaper, I would guess, just looking at it from a taxpayer point of view.
Well, you know,
or it could be.
No. I would say yes, because for a number of programs where you're getting the program at the end, if you go from sort of, let's just use dollar terms, if you go from a $100 a day residential-based program to a $1 a day transitional program, you're totally throwing your money away for the most part. Wow. Because the key is when the person gets it back out in the community, all the things that are relatively easy decisions to make when you don't have the opportunity to meet up with your old friend to start smoking and all that kind of stuff, suddenly now you have to learn how to do that stuff. So most of the research says unless you're willing to spend a substantial amount of the money in that transitional period of time, and that might be intensive supervision, it might be outpatient treatment program that consumes a big part of your week and things like that, you're just blowing your money in the earlier time. So what we're trying to do is to make the prison thing more effective, really, by having the having that money spent in the community.
Let's take a question. Stephen in Madison's been waiting quite a while. Stephen, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yes, well, my question is from a perspective of one who's experienced cages. I would say there's no real attempt to rehabilitate unbalanced sociopathic people. Instead, they sit for years in small cages, getting increasingly bitter and angry and thirsting for revenge. And then you say you return them to the community. Well, I'm sorry. The whole thing is a multi-zillion-dollar failure, and it's all about your prison industrial complex and keeping you lawyers, courts, and police fed.
Wow. What do you? Let's turn to John Chisholm, our Milwaukee County District Attorney. John?
It is an extraordinarily expensive endeavor. There's no question about it. And most participants in the system do not feel that we're being as effective with those resources as we could be. So what you're seeing now among prosecutors, for example, is movements towards working closely with individuals that will assess the risks and needs of the person early on, working with the public defender's office as the person is initially brought into the system, and then trying to come up with intelligent interventions from the minute they reach the stage that they're intersecting with law enforcement and being brought into the system, instead of waiting, for example, for months and months to unfold in the traditional process of a case where there is very little that goes on with respect to trying to intervene and change behaviors. If we start from the moment the person touches the system and we develop an intelligent way of tracking the person as they move through the system and give the system as many intelligent options to hold people accountable, and when necessary, to simply acknowledge that a person poses too big of a risk for the community and has to be removed. That would be a very different assessment than what the caller is talking about, where they may spend enormous amounts of time essentially just being held in cold storage while the process unfolds. What we want to do is make sure that we're applying the resources early because of that enormous back-end cost. And then what we've seen is many of the people coming back into the community and then just re-engaging in that behavior. And that means more victims. That means more court resources, more police resources, more prosecution and defense resources that have to go to address that fundamental issue that hasn't been addressed before. Now, for those individuals that engage in such dangerous behavior, we're talking essentially about incapacitation at that point in time. If you're sexually violent, we are in all likelihood going to remove you from the community in a constitutionally appropriate way and put strong supervision on you. And that's where the truth and sentencing framework works just fine. What we really want to be able to do is put the flexibility back into the system and let the judges control that, because that's the most accountable way of doing it. What we've created with now truth and sentencing 3 is really a confusing landscape that does not have the kind of transparency and accountability that I think the public demands.
You know, I think one thing that the caller brought up is, first of all, that we should, I would totally disagree. There are some sociopathic, so to speak, people who are going to be, and they perhaps might be some of the most angry people in prison because the prison system has identified them as the person who is least likely to change later on. And so they're going to then say, it seems like I'm always getting the bad end of every decision. Well, yeah, you are. But there's a whole bunch of other people who don't. I got involved in the system 27 years ago when I was conducting revocation hearings. And by the time I was looking at the behavior that had prompted, and this was back when we only had 3,000 prisoners as opposed to 23,000 prisoners, I'd say, my hands are tied right now, but we pretty much could see this coming down the tracks as the probation, and we could have intervened a little bit earlier in all that, and so why don't we do that kind of intervention? I think what the caller might be referring to is when you have try to have a system of a one-size-fits-all, and there really isn't. There's people with lots of different sizes, with lots of different shapes and all that kind of stuff. It gets very frustrating in your cell because you're trying to say, but that doesn't really apply to me. So the guy who really is rehabilitating himself, I'd be pretty angry about a truth in sentencing thing that says I have no control over whether I'm ever going to get released. And similarly, but on the other hand, there might be the person that John's talking about where the truth in sentencing thing, we wanted to have a whole lot of clarity because they say, you, John Doe, you are going to stay in prison for a long period of time. And the more that within the prison, that can be done from day one, where the one person says, okay, this is the track I'm on. I'm not happy with it, but that's the track I'm on. And the other person is able to do that. The less sort of trying to figure out how to game the system there's going to be by inmates.
I want to give Eunice in Frederick a chance to join in. Eunice, hello to you.
Well, maybe my question has been answered somewhere along the line. I don't know. But I have a daughter who rented a room in her home when she needed extra financial support to a friend who was a musician and someone that she had known for some time. And after a short time, before a year, she got some phone calls from the local pawn shop that he was pawning musical instruments and different things that belonged to her grown children. And so she went to check on them, and they were hers. And he ended in prison, and it was for like 4 months with rehabilitation after that time. The rehabilitation never happened. He apparently was going back on either alcohol or drugs, and I don't have the details. And so he ended up in prison again. Now, I have heard from various sources, including my representative, that Wisconsin is really down the line on rehabilitation for this type of problem, and wondered if you've already answered the question or if you can give me some help.
All right.
Well, in tough budget times, so remember, 27 years ago, we had 3,000 people. Right now, Wisconsin, if you think of the 28 states that make up the U.S. Census region that would be called the Northeast or the Midwest, when you combine county jail and state prisons, we're at the top of that. We use incarceration a whole lot. But the cost of incarcerating, or using John's word, incapacitating. So if you just incapacitate, let's just say that's just you're doing time and there's no education at all. As you expand your budget for cells, if you don't get a comparable expansion for your programs, you're getting fewer programs per prisoner day. And a big part when you're then in tough budget times, and the Department of Corrections is like any other department, in they're given instructions to say, how are you going to manage your budget? And so it's very hard because you need a fixed number of correctional officers to watch every post. You can't really cut back on that. So you cut back on what their luxuries, so to speak.
So
your rehabilitation programs within prisons are seen as optional.
Wouldn't it be turned around and have them start with rehabilitation, and then if that doesn't work, they go to prison?
A lot of times, the vast majority of offenders, and my guess when you said 4 months, is what happened is that particular guy was probably put on probation and given 4 months in the local county jail as a condition of probation, because you can't get a 4 month sentence. You have to get at least a year sentence or whatever. So possibly they attempted to hook him up with some kind of rehabilitation program, but he decided to just sort of forget about it, and they said, no, we're pretty serious about this. Now you're going to prison, That's probably what happened
probably
in your
what
case.
Happened.
And then, yet the case example is very familiar. Let's put it that way. You could change the names, and the same scenario plays out each and every day in the hundreds, certainly in Milwaukee County, where we have significant rates of reoffenses and failure under supervision that then, under the truth in sentencing framework, results in long terms of incarceration. So even if the judge had initially envisioned a relatively short stay in prison, but a fairly heavy hammer hanging over the person, in other words, a two-year prison sentence initially followed by, say, 4 years of extended supervision, if the reintegration in the community is not successful, they're going to spend all 4 years in the prison system, and that's an extraordinarily expensive proposition. It may be completely appropriate in certain circumstances, but again, that cost is real. And I often hear people say you can't put a price on justice, but that price is being put on us whether we want it to or not. And so the extent that we can inform that process and again, keep people safe and yet try to do so in a way that's sustainable. I think it's really our obligation as public safety officials to do that.
Yeah. Let me just give a medical analogy here, because the issue isn't so much the shortfall in budget for programming within the institution. It is the hugely radical change in what we spend per offender on community supervision versus prison. So if you're, imagine this, you build another hospital wing, and the way you're going to afford it, you're in an HMO kind of situation, is that you're going to tell the pharmacy to dilute the medicine that people take to avoid having to come into inpatient by to only a quarter of the regular strength. Well, some people might be able to make it, but there's going to be a whole lot of people that you're going to be admitting through the front door. And it's not because you didn't know how to yeah. avoid admitting it. It's because you made a budget decision to do that. So if you look at your local community corrections and you look at what the caseloads are that they have, you'd sort of be amazed at anything. I mean, I totally, truly respect the correctional officers, but when you look at what is expected of them and the caseloads that they have and the relatively limited lack of or access to other resources, that's why we're getting a whole lot of renewed behavior.
Eunice, thank you. I want to give Ken in Black River Falls a chance. Ken, hello.
Hello. Up here in Black River Falls, we're lucky. We have a very effective drug court, which is making a difference for a lot of people that would be normally being incarcerated because of addiction problems. It's been working pretty well. The question I have for you, though, is on reduced risk sentencing called RRS.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell people a bit about that? And also, what do you feel is the best argument to put a person in an RRS situation where they're able to reduce their time in jail, or prison rather, by 25%?
John, do you want to do that?
I'd be happy to. I believe strongly that the system should work the way it's intended to work. And if you put the proper structures in place that make an offender accountable for his or her actions and responsible for their rehabilitation, then it's our obligation also to provide the resources to do that. And in the drug treatment court model, what you're seeing is an acknowledgement among the sort of the initial assessment workers, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the judges, and the law enforcement officials that the sooner we begin this work and the more structure that's applied early on, the greater the results. And you are right. The drug treatment courts, one of which we just inaugurated finally in Milwaukee County in 2009, is showing tremendous promise along with a concept that we're trying to pioneer of universal screening, where the first time the person comes in, they're being assessed and determine what the appropriate response of the system should be. The idea behind all of that is, again, keeping people safe in the community, making sure that we base our decisions on evidence and that we're not just doing the same old thing because the process takes over. I think in the state, an industrial-based state, we've adopted sort of an industrial model of public safety, where we put the process over the substance sometimes. And what we're really moving towards with drug treatment models and reduced risk sentencing is much more of an evidence-based model that gives us information at critical junctures in the decision-making framework that we can then keep people safe and do it in an accountable way. It's as opposed to just sounding tough. You know, it's the classic, you know, I just put them away in prison, and I ignore the whether or not it was actually successful to do it or not. This is really a much more accountable and quite frankly, a much tougher thing to do. It actually requires more investment of time and resources from prosecutors and from law enforcement and from the defense bar, and that often doesn't get reflected in the numbers at the end of the year. You sometimes just count how many cases are issued instead of saying, you know, what was the ultimate result? What did we do with this person while we had him to make sure that the behavior was changed? Or if it was appropriate, did we simply make the determination that they were too big a risk and move towards not giving them the option of a reduced sentence? In other words, you're too big of a risk, you're shooting people, you're robbing people, we're going to pull you off the street, and we're not even talking about alternatives at that level.
I think the other thing that's sort of interesting is when you look at risk reduction sentences, I could say that looks like parole to me. It's the old-fashioned way saying, I'm going to make a decision that says this guy can earn his way out of prison. And then you make it real clear right up front to the DOC, program accordingly. My expectation is this guy's going to make it out. I think what we too often do is, without naming a crime, but let's just say you have a kid who broke a window and you're upset with him and you give him some discipline, and then you come home the next day and you say, what happened today? And he says, I didn't break any windows. Well, that's a pretty low threshold. You know what I mean? And that's sort of what we're doing in many cases on probation is to say, break any windows lately? And all that kind of stuff. Well, I think we can be more ambitious than that. And frankly, I think the proposal that we have to put a focus on not taking away truth in sentencing for the guys that the judge objectively and intuitively say no, they are not to be released. But once those are moved aside, that by focusing back again on the presence of positive behavior and growth as opposed to the absence of bad behavior, we'll get a lot more out of both probation and also our incarceration.
And I think what Ken and I would hope would come out of this proposal is just robust discussion. It is not an ideological approach. In other words, there are things here that whatever framework you're coming from, you can see some real practical benefits to. If you're a fiscal conservative, you understand that we have to do something to control these costs. If you're a tough on crime person, you know that you still have that option to use the truth in sentencing framework. If you're a person that's deeply concerned about changing behaviors and reintegrating people in the community, then you can see that the framework exists to take advantage of those resources. And so what we're really arguing for is a much more rational approach to how we do public safety, and it really requires buy-in from a broad spectrum of people, because they can look at it and they can say, this is rational, it makes sense, it's accountable, and there's the very little risk of being painted into any particular corner. And in the end, the responsibility for the effectiveness rests with those that are charged with that responsibility.
On that note, we have to close. I hope you guys will come back and be with us again. It was an interesting discussion, to say the least. I'm looking forward to hearing if there's any progress toward what you were talking about. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for being with us today. Ken Strait, UW-Madison Law School Clinical Associate Professor, one of our guests. The other, Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. And we'll revisit this. It was an interesting discussion. I think there's a lot more we could have talked about. But we're going to move on, and I'm looking forward to our next program as well. We have a rich cultural culinary heritage here in the state of Wisconsin. And I think, you know, you think about cheese as one, but there's also a renaissance of home preservation afoot. in part to serve to save money, and part to eat more local and seasonal, and kind of savor the abundance of food that we have. And we'll be talking about that with our two guests coming up next as we visit about Wisconsin's fermented foods. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.